You are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Welcome to a Tuesday edition of Locked On NBA, your daily NBA podcast. I'm Wes Goldberg, and I'm here with David Ramil. We'll be joined by Rob Mahoney from Sports Illustrated later on in the show to discuss SI's top 100 player rankings for next season. And we'll get to what's next for Team USA. But first, Locked On NBA is presented by Indochino. Indochino is the world's most exciting made-to-measure menswear company this week. Our listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $369 at Indochino.com. Enter promo code LOCKEDON at checkout. Let's start with the Lakers, David, because Anthony Davis recently told Yahoo Sports' Chris Haynes that LeBron James wants him to become the focal point of the offense. And here's what Chris wrote. As soon as the framework for the Blackwester trade was agreed upon with New Orleans in June, James, who will be entering his 17th NBA season, promptly held conversations with higher-ups in the organization and expressed his views on why it's imperative that Davis becomes the focal point of the team's offensive identity. League sources told Yahoo Sports, end quote. Look, everything about this is right. This is exactly what the Lakers should be doing. But we've also heard this kind of stuff with LeBron before. And frankly, David, I'll believe it when I see it.
Well, can I just go on record first and foremost and say that I am already sick of Lakers talk in September? I mean, we haven't even gotten to the regular season yet. And I am already fed up with Lakers drama. I mean, between the Anthony Davis trade, all of which extended from last season, to the LeBron James era here, I just, so much of it, and I'm kind of sick of it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, when we were exchanging texts earlier this morning and talking about this article, you basically just responded, ugh.
Yes, I am not ready to get into any kind of Anthony Davis drama, but to address the LeBron James issue here, I don't see it. I really don't think it's going to happen. I mean, we've heard this kind of talk from LeBron James in the past. He always says he's willing to make changes. He's always willing to accede a little bit of power and control. And yet, he never does. And I don't think he ever will. And I realize now that he has to try and assuage Anthony Davis's feelings a little bit. He's new to the team here. He's forced his trade from New Orleans. He's lost quite a bit of popularity as a result. And now he's got to try to make him feel more welcome, more a part of the offense. But we've always seen LeBron James do this. And the reality is he always comes to the realization that the offense runs better when he's in charge. And I just don't see how that would possibly change.
Right. And the offense runs better when he's in charge. And you can't really argue with the results so far in his career. But with Anthony Davis, it is a little bit different. I don't know if it's better or worse, but it's different because in the past with Miami, it was Dwayne Wade and it was LeBron. And LeBron joined Wade in Miami. It was supposed to be 1A and 1A, and they were just going to dominate the league together. And in that second season, Dwayne Wade had to take that step back. LeBron takes control. In Cleveland, he talked about wanting Kyrie Irving to have the ball, and he was going to play on the wing a little bit more, be more perimeter-oriented, and let Kyrie handle the offense. And what did he do? He took the ball out of Kyrie's hands a whole bunch of times, and he controlled the offense, and it ran through him, and they won a championship. In Los Angeles with Anthony Davis, Anthony Davis is unlike any other star player LeBron has ever played with in that he is a center, that he's a 7 feet tall human who is the second best player on that team, and that has never really been the case for LeBron James. The closest thing to it, David, is that final year in Miami when Dwayne Wade only played 54 games in that 2014 season, Chris Bosh was arguably the second best player on that team. He was definitely the most available player on that team, I think that's fair to say. And that season, Chris Bosh took 2.8 threes per game, the most at that point in his career by far. And as far as how Anthony Davis is going to look like as the focal point of the offense, maybe it's something like that two-man game between LeBron and Bosh. It was a whole lot of pick and pop, a whole lot of pick and roll. Bosh was the anchor of that defense. Anthony Davis also stated in that Chris Haynes piece that he wants to win Defensive Player of the Year. So maybe it's something like the LeBron-Bosch thing, but on steroids.
I understand where you're getting at there, but even still, like, Chris Bosch was a better, I think, perimeter and mid-range shooter at that point in time. Even at that stage in his career where he was expanding his three-point range, yeah, he only took 2.8 attempts per game, but he still shot 34%. I think even in the mid-range, he was probably a little bit more effective than Anthony Davis yet. But still, part of what makes Davis so effective is his speed and strength, his ability to get to the rim, to break down a defense, and be able to, again, get an easier shot at the rim. if you're taking that part away from him and keeping him basically to a perimeter-based offensive player, isn't that limiting him? And as far as the defensive player of the year factor is concerned, is he going to be exerting that much energy on the defensive end that it's going to take away from his offense, especially if he's going to be the focal point? Is he ready for that responsibility to be both the best defensive player?
If he's the focal point on offense and the defensive player of the year candidate, he's MVP.
Well,
that's the kind of season we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, that is the factor there. But I'm not so sure if they want to reduce him to that point. And still, what are you going to be doing with LeBron James and pick and roll situations there? Or pick and pop? He's going to be the ball handler there. And then you look at the rest of that offense, the rest of that roster, and who's going to be making up the difference there? Who along the perimeter is going to be bailing them out when eventually the defense collapses and forces things there? What do you do if Anthony Davis is still playing the power forward position? We have JaVale McGee or Dwight Howard there clogging the paint. What is that? Yeah. Where does that, you know, offense release from? Like, where is the release valve for that offense? Because right now, all you've got is Danny Green, and I'm not sure what else you have along the perimeter that can knock down shots consistently.
Well, you bring up a good point with Dwight and JaVale McGee clogging up the paint, because Anthony Davis has said he wants to play power forward, that he prefers to play power forward. And again, in this piece, he says that he is willing to play center, but his concern, and look, I think it's a legit one, his concern is that he doesn't want to deal with the wear and tear over the course of an 82-game regular season, understanding that he could still play the five in crunch time, and he's probably going to have to play that position a whole lot in the playoffs, because you probably don't want to be playing Dwight Howard and JaVale McGee a whole bunch of minutes in the playoffs. So if it's from like a load management concern, yeah, I get it. But that doesn't really go hand in hand with also being the focal point of the offense, because if we're talking about Anthony Davis at the four not being able to get to the rim, like you were saying, because you have a true center there clogging up the paint who can't stretch the floor in a way that Anthony Davis can, then you're really limiting him. And now you're talking about like something that looks too similar to the Kevin Love situation, at least offensively, that I think anybody would be comfortable, especially considering what the Lakers had to give up to get Anthony Davis.
Yeah, I wonder if this is an opportunity here that we're... Obviously, the Los Angeles Lakers are going to need an adjustment period here, but I wonder if this is going to be a potential issue down the road, because we know from LeBron James, he's made these kind of statements in the past. Is he going to just take back control? Is he going to, if he does, relinquish some control earlier in the season, which he has done in the past, and then when he sees maybe it doesn't work nearly as effectively as he thinks it should or will, then what happens? Does he gripe about coaching? Does he gripe about Anthony Davis? Does he gripe about anything at all? Does he just slowly and assuredly take control back and kind of change to what has worked best over the course of his career?
Right, and I just still don't understand how you make Anthony Davis the focal point of the offense if he's playing power forward, because there's just not much room to move for him. I mean, when it worked in New Orleans, it worked with DeMarcus Cousins being able to stretch the floor and basically play point center. It worked with Julius Randle doing a lesser version of that a little bit last season in the few minutes that they had together. But I just don't see the way that it works with JaVale McGee and Dwight Howard. So I think at some point, and look, we know the roster concerns with the Lakers. We don't have to get all into that again, but it feels like if they want to make Anthony Davis the focal point of the offense truly, if LeBron truly wants that, then he's going to have to play center. And I don't think that that's the best case scenario for a team that wants to load manage him, if that's indeed what they want to do. So they're going to have to figure it out. Look, this is going to be clunky. And I think we've seen that every time LeBron has switched teams or has gotten a new co-star, it's been clunky at first. I'm sure they'll figure it out. There's an easy way that it makes sense. We've talked about it 100 times. LeBron has the ball in his hands. Anthony Davis plays center, and you surround the two of them with shooters. That's the way it works. It'll be interesting how long it takes them to finally get to that point. But let's wrap it up here. Rob Mahoney joins us next. You're listening to Locked On NBA. Team USA will advance to the next round of the World Cup, and we'll get to that in a minute. But Rob Mahoney joins us now. And every year, Rob, you go through this practice of ranking the top 100 players in the league. And I'm sure your mentions are glowing afterwards. But tell us about your process, because it's really detailed, and it's clear that you've put a lot of thought into it.
Yeah, I mean, this is the first year of doing this ranking without my former colleague Ben Golliver, now with the Washington Post. And so it was a little different. You know, usually it was a little bit more collaborative, a little bit more going back and forth with him, arguing about players. This year, more arguing with myself and then getting some feedback from the rest of our staff at SI. So I mean, personally, I start with a raw player pool. I go through every player who played in the NBA last season and pull anyone who I think has even a remote chance of making it. I think that list was maybe around 155 players. And so from there, it's grouping them into tiers, separating those tiers into kind of broad positions, because I want to make sure that all the, you know, the ball handlers are kind of in the order that I would like, and all the combo forwards are kind of in the order that I would like. And then from those separate groups, I kind of start aggregating. Do I want, you know, if I look at the top ball handler, the top wing, the top combo forward, the top big man, which of those players do I want? And work through all those lists. Then you could start scrubbing. You go spot by spot. You look at, okay, is number 67 really better than number 68? And then, as I mentioned, there's been kind of an exhaustive review and feedback process with our staff, kind of getting their feedback just to make sure that, you know, without Ben, I can be as unreasonably high on Danilo Gallinari as I want to be, but it's good to have some other opinions in the room.
I mean, Pascal Siakam was the breakout star of last year. He wasn't on last season's top 100 list, I don't think, and he wasn't on the snub list last year. He's in your top 50 this season. Who do you think could be this year's Pascal Siakam?
Ooh, that's a great question. I mean, I think it could be some of these younger guys. I mean, DeAndre Ayton didn't make our list, for example. He's one of those players who, when it clicks, that could start to look really interesting. You know, Marvin Bagley's probably in a similar category. There's a lot of players who I think could jump from in consideration to very strongly in the 50-60 range. You know, if you're high on Mitchell Robinson, for example, I think he's another young guy who could jump into that. What makes Siakam so strange is that I feel like we had a decent understanding of who the player he was, and then he just completely eclipsed it in every way. And it's not in a sense where he kind of scaled up from being a role player to a slightly better role player, but by doing the things that stars do, by scoring in isolation, by running, you know, pick and rolls and post-ups and doing all that stuff really efficiently. So, I mean, Siakam, I think the NBA would agree, was very hard to predict given that he was the most improved player. You know, De'Aaron Fox is in a similar category, a guy who wasn't on our list and will be in our top 50. So it's tough to peg those guys, but I don't anticipate anyone being quite as exaggerated as Siakam was this year.
I was looking through the list, and among the many things that stood out, there was one particular grouping there, two back-to-back selections, at number 98 and 97, respectively, DeAndre Jordan and Jared Allen. And you look at their positions and the fact that they play on the same team, and I wonder what the thought process is. Or is it just by individually ranking them and that's just kind of where they wind up falling out, or do you have to kind of tweak it a little bit considering the fact that, well, they're both in the same team and they're arguably going to be taking away from each other's minutes and altering how productive they are in during the upcoming season? How difficult is that for you to make that kind of final decision?
Well, I think in a general sense, I think there were a couple points of emphasis for me coming into this year's ranking, things I wanted to make sure that we were looking at closely, that I was getting as, you know, as close to right as we could. And one of them was really looking at these big guys who are a little bit exploitable in the playoffs, would have trouble staying on the floor in a competitive series, especially if it goes small. And both of those guys fit that bill, Jared Allen, DeAndre Jordan. I think, you know, even though they could be really important regular season players, you know, assuming DeAndre Jordan tries harder than he did last year, I think both of those guys are in kind of the 20-minute range, best case scenario in a long-term playoff situation. And so that's something that, you know, kind of ended up dropping them both on the list relative to maybe where they would have been in previous seasons. But then, as I mentioned, you know, I want to make sure in making this list that the centers are in the order that I want them to be in. And so I think there's some context there in the sense that when the Nets signed DeAndre Jordan, my, you know, the alarms in my brain went off thinking Jared Allen is a better player than DeAndre Jordan. Why would they do that? And there's obviously, you know, interpersonal reasons for that. I think, you know, that's a whole different can of worms.
It kind of felt like you ranking Jared Allen over DeAndre Jordan was a little bit of a subtweet to the Nets organization saying, start the right guy.
I mean, if you're handing tens of millions of dollars to a guy, you may want to make sure he's, you know, better than your existing starting center, but that's neither here nor there, I guess. But yeah, so I mean, on that level, I think that was definitely in my mind. The fact that objectively, I think Jared Allen was a better basketball player last season than DeAndre Jordan. In terms of the team context, for the purposes of this ranking, I'm trying to consider all these guys in a vacuum. And so it's not necessarily Jared Allen, member of the Brooklyn Nets, but Jared Allen as a concept, as, you know, how he would fit on all variety of teams, you know, contending teams, lottery teams, teams that are in the middle, ones, you know, fighting for that eighth seed, and kind of how does he fit with those groups? And so the Nets example isn't necessarily how you ground that context, but I think with those two guys, it inevitably kind of seeps into your brain on some level.
So given that you know, we've just seen the first 50 players of the list, and obviously you'll probably catch a lot of heat for the, you know, top 50. You know, obviously what you were mentioning beforehand, that Klay Thompson is a player that has gotten you into some trouble as far as the ranking is concerned, 58, and there's obvious context there and the knee injury and everything else, but this is your opportunity to kind of explain it maybe to our listeners that might be among that group that kind of challenges that ranking, because obviously Clay's probably a far better player than 58th in the league, but the injury does play a significant factor.
Oh, very far. And I think if you think about where his injury is going to put him in the season, and think about it in the terms of this vacuum where, sure, because Klay Thompson plays for the Warriors, he's going to be able to rehab and come back, and they're probably going to be a very good playoff team even without him, and he'll be able to come in and make a difference for the playoffs. If Klay Thompson is playing for the Charlotte Hornets, for example, he doesn't have that luxury. You know, he's working his way back from rehab. He comes back. His team is 10 games under 500. And they don't really have a shot. And that season is effectively over. He's going to play a month or two of meaningless basketball in a pretty good case recovery scenario. And that's it. So, I mean, our ranking looks explicitly at one season. So Kevin Durant is not going to be on our list. DeMarcus Cousins is not going to be on the list. John Wall not going to be on the list, specifically because of their injuries. And that's tough, especially because, you know, Kevin Durant, I think, had a very good case to be the number one player this year. It's certainly kind of his window, and he checks a lot of boxes that if you look at the other number one candidates, maybe they don't in certain ways. He kind of is across the board a really good candidate for that spot. But that's the way that we make the list, trying to take into account the actual scenario of next season and what that means for the injured players involved. And so to put Klay at 58 when he may end up playing one or two months of basketball next season and maybe less, depending on when his team is eliminated in the regular season or the playoffs, I think that's a pretty generous spot and really shows a lot of respect to the player he is and the worker he is to maybe potentially get back slightly earlier.
I mean, Gordon Hayward took a similar hit last season coming off of that injury that he had 2 years ago, and he still hasn't recovered from that. He's still ranked right there around Klay Thompson, I believe, and still dealing with the lingering effects of that injury that impacted his overall athleticism, and he may never become that top 15-ish player that he was before. I mean, there must be... I mean, that's the fear if you're a Warriors fan, that's what happens then to Klay Thompson, although I would say for Klay, the shooting puts him above Gordon Hayward. He doesn't rely necessarily as much on athleticism as Gordon Hayward did.
Yeah, but I mean, you may not have even thought that of Hayward going in. Yes, he is an athletic player. He moves very well. It was a big part of why he was a good defender, why he was a good playmaker. But you would have thought some of the supplementary skills would have held him over. And I think it goes to show, when your body's not right, sometimes it just takes a lot of time to get back. And so that's the thing with Klay, where even if he does come back early, what kind of player is he going to be for that month or two of the season relative to his previous standards? It's not going to be full-speed Klay Thompson. Hayward is an interesting one, because I think we kind of have him flagged in a sense as a player who, if he plays the same this year as he did last year for the Celtics, then he's going to be due for an even more significant drop, because Gordon Hayward was not the 59th best player in basketball last season. I think this ranking reflects in a lot of ways kind of trying to bridge those two extremes, the Gordon Hayward who we have seen over years of a body of work and the player he ultimately could be if he kind of gets back to where he was before, and the player he was, you know, specifically for the Celtics, which was in a lot of cases, you know, I think best case scenario inconsistent, maybe most generously, but more realistically just was not that good a player overall.
Players 100 through 50 are up now. You can see that at si.com/NBA. The rest will be unveiled over the next several days. Rob, can you give us a tease of anything that will surprise people in your rankings or get you in trouble like the Klay Thompson thing did?
I mean, I think Devin Booker is always a good bet. You know, I think there are certainly guys, and, you know, Zach LaVine has been kind of in this category for the bottom 50, guys who are big-time scorers on bad teams. And it's kind of, you know, going back to kind of what our points of emphasis were for this year, that was another one where it's great if you put up a lot of points, get a lot of rebounds, but how does that translate in terms of the on-off impact stats, in terms of your team's overall offense? What are you actually doing? You know, how far, if you're going to lead an offense, where are you taking that offense? And so, you know, Booker is a classic example of this, who, you know, just did not have a lot of help in a lot of ways, which makes him tough to evaluate, had to do too much as a result of that. And so how you evaluate a player like Booker, I think, probably says a lot about how you view basketball. And I think I usually view basketball differently than a lot of people who watch Devin Booker, apparently.
Luckily, he did not have to face any double teams in your selection process. So.
It's true. He can thank Golliver for leaving on that one.
That's Rob Mahoney, who does great work over at Sports Illustrated. Check out the top 100 player rankings over at si.com/NBA. Thanks for coming on, Rob.
Thanks, guys.
Buy or sell is next. You're listening to Locked On NBA. We'll end today's show with a friendly game of buy or sell. David, Team USA beat Brazil 89-73 on Monday to advance to the quarterfinals. They'll play France on Wednesday after the win. Are you buying or selling confidence in Team USA?
I'm holding pat. As you know, I haven't been exactly overconfident or even particularly confident about Team USA's chances. I like what they've been able to accomplish. Obviously, they've had some pretty tight games there, but I think they've found their identity. And partly what makes me not necessarily confident, but encouraged in that they're at least understanding their roles on this team. They know where their bread is buttered. It's through defense, solid offensive play, not taking too many chances. They're not overwhelming anybody with talent. And so they're sticking to that game plan, and they're playing it as best as you can possibly imagine, given the fact that they haven't had as much time as some of these other teams to practice. Now, all that being said, they're going to be facing their toughest competition moving forward, not just France, but potentially Australia, Spain, Serbia, all of which could have a very good chance of upsetting the USA team.
Right. I have been less confident since the Turkey game, but I am more confident the more games they play, the more time passes. Time is their best friend right now for Team USA because they lack two things, right? They lack talent and they lack continuity. Well, they're not getting talent. This is the team, obviously. So they're not getting any of the superstars. So what they need is continuity. And the more time they play together, obviously, the more they're going to gel. And this is helping them do that. I think we're seeing the defense get a little bit more on the string. We're seeing Greg Popovich figure out a couple of tinkering ways to utilize his players and to utilize the rotation. And so the more they play together, and when they get a guy like Jason Tatum back and they're able to figure out ways to find easier offense, then I have more confidence in them. That said, I still would have Serbia as the favorite, but as long as Team USA can do these things, I'm not ruling them out. It's going to be competitive, and I think a lot of people are excited around the world are excited for it to just be competitive. But I'm with you. I'm not buying any more confidence. I'm not selling any of the confidence I have now. I'm standing pat. The NBA is banning ninja-style headwear this season, citing safety concerns. Are you buying or selling that, David?
Well, I'm clearly buying that it's a huge mistake. I think it's ridiculous. I can't recall at any point last season where those headbands led to any kind of injury. It just seems like a bunch of old men in a corporate boardroom somewhere griping about things that they're not familiar with, that they don't like them. Maybe they're a little too, I don't know, urban or ethnic for them, maybe. None of it makes sense. I don't understand exactly what the rationale is. They make it seem like they have to form some kind of really hackneyed old committee to kind of explore whether or not these are beneficial, whether or not there's any kind of point. It's just a fashion accessory. Who cares? Let them play in it. I mean, it's not changing anything. It doesn't impact the games one way or the other. It's cool to look at. It's fun. It's interesting. We had players wear them all throughout last year, from Jrue Holiday to Jimmy Butler and others. I don't think anybody ever sustained any injuries. I'm not sure what the issue is. And all of it seems kind of flimsy and somewhat, to me anyway, racially motivated.
Whoa. Well, this is a huge mistake because they look awesome. Nobody got hurt wearing them. I don't see the problem here. They're really cool looking. And the NBA, if nothing else, is a really great league for accessories. And we have seen those kinds of accessories have a lot of influence on the league. A lot of the players liked the ninja headbands last year. I don't see anybody pulling anybody down by the ninja headband. That doesn't seem to me like a thing NBA players would want to even do in the first place. I don't understand what the problem is here. This is not a tackling sport. There's no issue with the ninja-style headwear. It's not like it's getting caught in a fan anywhere. Let them wear it. It looks awesome. Let them wear it. This is a mistake, and I hope they bring them back. Finally, David, you recently went to Central Florida and covered the Junior NBA Global Championship. You wrote an article about it for Forbes that was really good. I wanted to talk to you about it. In the form of our buy or sell game, are you buying or selling the experience as a valuable one for the young kids?
Oh, absolutely. I think if you consider the fact that half the participants are travelers from all over the globe, from places as far away as India, their first experience in the United States is to attend and participate in the Junior NBA Global Championship. They're treated to a day at the park. They get the full immersive experience of what it's like to be part of the NBA /WNBA. There are seminars on everything from hydration to meditation to mental wellness to staying prepared. Through the week-long of competition that they're there, they're learning skills on and off the floor. There is a day of service where they're able to build a park in a nearby city. all these things that they're learning about the NBA quote-unquote way of doing things, and they're learning from it, and it's such a great benefit for them. They get to talk to real NBA and WNBA players, from Breanna Stewart to Nick Anderson to Bo Outlaw to Dwayne Wade. All these guys are there throughout the week. They're there to talk to these kids, to serve as an example for them of what the success could be potentially like. And all these kids are learning from them. It's, to me, it's a really great opportunity for them and for the league as well. You know, there's no mistaking the fact that the league is growing as a business because of their influence. They're expanding their global reach. They have NBA academies set up in all these places throughout the world. They get these kids to learn about basketball, and then eventually some of them form teams and compete and then make their way to Orlando if they're lucky enough.
I mean, you look at the type of experience that Steph Curry had hanging out with his dad growing up, and the advantage that he had just being immersed in the NBA type of culture, in the world that is professional basketball, and how much that helped him, because you walk into the NBA atmosphere, it's not foreign to you. So I'm buying it. That's it for today. Remember, listen to and subscribe to and archived episodes of Locked On NBA on Himalaya, as well as on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. If you're on iTunes, please leave us a review. Thanks for listening.